Good morning. I'm Irene White-Reed from the Enough Projects Communications Department, and I'd like to welcome and thank you for participating in this press conference on recommendations to the Obama administration for policy changes regarding some of the most intransigent conflicts on the continent of Africa. I'm going to turn you over to the Enough Project's Executive Director, John Norris, and then to our co-chair, John Prendergast. Both are Africa and genocide policy experts, and they are co-authors of the report I have sent to each of you entitled Obama, Africa, and Peace. This call is being recorded and will be posted on our website. And right now, I'd like to introduce you to Enough Project Executive Director, John Norris.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. Basically, what John and I argue in the paper is that President Obama does have a chance to fundamentally transform our relations with Africa, and we think that can be achieved by making essential investments and significant investments in peacemaking and taking a much smarter and more comprehensive approach to peacemaking. Obviously, the fact that Obama is the first African-American president has gotten a lot of attention and created a lot of excitement on the continent. I think it's also important to note that he's not only the first African-American president, he's also president with direct African roots, and I think that's been part of the intense excitement on the continent about his presidency. I think in a lot of ways, President-elect Obama is very well positioned to transform the relationship and break out a bit of the cycle that we've been in the last couple of years. I think one of the most important things is that after September 11th, U.S. foreign policy towards Africa really shifted back to almost the Cold War approach. Countries were seen as either being for us or against us, based on their track record on anti-terrorism activities. I think that's why we saw some very mixed messages towards governments such as Sudan's, where they were offering counterterrorism cooperation while at the same time conducting a genocide in Darfur. And I think by taking a more nuanced approach, by looking at how governments treat their own people, the investments they're making in their own people, their human rights record, the record on democracy, their willingness to cooperate in multilateral institutions, I think we can begin to move into a much more sophisticated and nuanced approach to the continent that would be welcome on both sides of the ocean. I also think the fact that the president-elect is African-American really does take a wind out of some of the old North-South debates that have always been a real fixture of American foreign policy. President Mugabe, who is quite fond of over-the-top rhetoric, I don't think we'll have a lot of luck decrying President Obama as the former colonial master or simply decrying his efforts and foreign policy on the continent as some Machiavellian plot. And I think that really does offer an important opportunity to set the reset button in relations and hopefully move beyond kind of the strongman era that is still in play in some parts of the continent. I also think, in contrast to the Bush administration, the new administration really does have an opportunity to revive investments and efforts to expand and improve cooperation among multilateral institutions in Africa. I think if you look at African institutions, they need to move beyond simply membership being determined solely on the basis of geography and really move toward a period where they're building along the lines of shared values, of institutions that are shaped with members who share a commitment to democracy, to human rights, to the responsibility to protect, to promoting trade across borders. And I think that kind of multilateral institution building was quite hard under the Bush administration because from the UN on down, there were an awful lot of members of the Bush administration who really held multilateral institution building in very low regard, and I think that sent a very negative message in terms of cooperation. We've also heard a lot about African solutions to African problems over the last couple of years, and I think that debate, unfortunately, has often been a way for both U.S. policymakers and African policymakers to avoid the hard decisions and avoid doing the right thing. I think, first and foremost, we need to understand that if African regional institutions really are going to create African solutions to African problems, that they need to understand they have to be responsive to the needs and interests of Africans and not just African heads of state. if you have people that are being persecuted, if you have populations that are continuing victims of ethnic violence, crimes against humanity, that is not simply a matter that can be set aside because it would upset one ruling party or one ruling leader. But I think it's also incumbent on the international community to understand that fundamental violations of international human rights norms, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, those aren't just African problems. Those are fundamentally international problems that demand an international response. And they simply can't be pawned off on the continent as something that should be addressed locally, and maybe we'll provide some minor logistical support in doing that. So I think there's real onus of responsibility on both sides to move toward a new approach. I think, obviously, I feel optimistic about the potential for an administration to transform relations with the continent. I think we have to be very realistic that there are some very, very tough problems across the continent right now in Congo, in Somalia, in Sudan, in Zimbabwe. It is not going to be easy at all for this administration moving forward. But again, I would stress that peacemaking and taking a much smarter regional approach to peacemaking has to be fundamental to that effort, and that has to be coupled with long-term investments in development, in crisis prevention, and in building institutions that really understand those key issues. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, John Prendergast.
Thank you, John. You know, in order to make that happen, I think the bottom line is that we believe we have to shift the United States policy in Africa from its present state of managing the symptoms of Africa's biggest wars, like the ones we're talking about in this paper, where we simply respond with literally billions of dollars in humanitarian aid and in support for peace observer missions, which don't get to the heart of things. We need to shift to a policy of false objective of ending these conflicts, which means you have to restructure organizationally. And I worked in the White House in the State Department, and we're not structured for success in peacemaking. We're structured to manage symptoms and manage the symptoms of crisis, basically. So we offer some ideas in how we can restructure organization. We figure that you probably have questions about some of the specific conflicts, but I thought just for a minute I'd like to tell you about the restructuring organizationally, and then we can probably get into some specifics on the conflicts themselves. But structurally, number one, we need a diplomatic surge. You know, people talk about intelligence surges, where you put all the intelligence assets on a particular problem if you need the information. Well, we need more foreign service officers and country experts and issue experts in our embassies in Central and East Africa where the conflicts are erupting. And they need to be coordinated very clearly and be meeting regularly with each other. And their focus needs to be uniformly and exclusively on conflict resolution. Secondly, we need back in Washington to back it up with an interagency task force that helps shape the diplomatic strategy and is buttressed and supported by country experts and issue experts so that they can think outside the box and come up with ideas. The third thing we need in this restructuring is certainly a re-emphasis, as we saw in the previous, and as we did not see over the last 8 years, on special envoys. Special envoys, when deployed appropriately, can help bring gravitas to a conflict resolution effort. And if they're sufficiently senior, they can command the kind of respect in presidential palaces throughout the continent that you want and need. But it has to be the right kind of people, and that takes some vetting and effort to do so. Fourth thing structurally is actually bringing some of these people back to Washington, bringing some of the combatants back to Washington, having meetings in D.C. with the hosted by the United States government where we can kickstart some of the more difficult peace efforts in coordination and conjunction with our allies and with others that are involved, but certainly giving it the weight of more direct United States involvement. And then you have to have, in each department that's relevant, a senior official who is the point person for that agency, for that department, on how on increasing U.S. investment in peacemaking. So we talk about those things and how they might happen, and then we basically get into the specific countries, particularly the three deadliest conflicts in Africa and arguably the world, Sudan, Congo, and Somalia. And in 1 minute, you know, the bottom line on Sudan is we think we need a peace surge. There needs to be an effort to end the war in Darfur and implement the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, is going to issue its indictment of Bashir sometime in the next 30 days. This will provide an incredible opportunity, very dangerous moment, but incredible opportunity to potentially sideline Bashir and give impetus to resolution as people that would, within the ruling party that would muscle Bashir out, will want to avoid his fate. Congo, the stakes have risen fairly dramatically with the split in the rebel, the main rebel group, the CNDP. We need, of course, a focus on a peace deal that involves all of these actors and a better plan than what is emerging to neutralize the remnants of the genocidaire, the FDLR, in eastern Congo, and some strategy that simply doesn't exist right now, a strategy to begin to deal with the biggest driver of conflict in eastern Congo that none of these governments or diplomats ever talk about, which is the conflict minerals that fuel the rebels and the militias and even the Congolese and Rwandan governments and their continuous manipulation in the east. And then finally, Somalia. With Ethiopia's withdrawal, there's really an opportunity now. Of course, there's going to be problems in the short term with some of these hardline Islamist groups, Shabab elements, taking over parts of Mogadishu. And that's definitely a concern. But in the longer run, there is a new opportunity with the withdrawal of Ethiopia as it leaves to build a peace, a government of national unity from the bottom up. There are all these elements throughout the country that control the local areas that need to be engaged through clans, through, in some cases, their ideological organizations, through some of these moderate Islamist groups, and through the Djibouti process, as it's called, the UN-led process, a strengthened one if the United States would add its gravitas to it. We think there is a chance there for peace that did not exist as long as the Somalia's main rival, Ethiopia, was militarily intervening in the country. So there is some cause for hope in Somalia that simply didn't exist before Ethiopia's withdrawal. So those are some of the issues we're raising, and turn it over now to questions for the people on the call now.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If you're using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. If at any time your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing #. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Please hold while we poll for questions. Our first question comes from the New York Times. Please state your question.
I just wanted to know how optimistic you are in terms of getting attention on Africa, given the sort of twin crises of the world financial markets and Gaza. And also, just specifically to the UN, the Ambassador Rice has been on record as saying they didn't want to repeat the mistakes of Rwanda in Sudan, but I'm wondering, given the way that kind of forces in Darfur have all fractured, whether that's really whether you can compare the two.
Yeah, John, do you want me to field that one? This is John Norris. Sorry for the two Johns confusion. I think I'm still reasonably optimistic. Certainly, the financial crisis does have some resource implications, and I think the battle over expanded budgets for diplomacy and development will certainly be acute. But the administration certainly is populated with people that have long felt that dealing with these acute situations, mass atrocities, crimes against humanity, from Senator Clinton to Susan Rice to the president himself, that they've all spoken about this passionately at length. And I don't think that they will just walk away from this agenda because of some other pressing things. And I think if we wait for the situation in the Middle East to resolve itself before we move on to Africa, it would be a very long wait indeed. And I think clearly we've learned some very tough lessons in the 1990s about what works and what doesn't work as far as UN peacekeeping and UN peacemaking goes. And it was quite unfortunate over the last couple of years that I think the administration walked away from some of those lessons. In Sierra Leone and Kosovo and Bosnia and Timor, we learned that peacekeeping with UN involvement works if you've got a clear, empowered, credible military at the head of that operation. If it's the UK, if it's the US, if it's the Australians. And we've learned that if you subcontract it out to developing nations without a clear lead, without a clear mandate, I think has been done to date in Darfur with UNAMID, as the UN is threatening to do in Somalia right now, it doesn't work. And I think it's pretty clear what works and what doesn't work with UN forces on the ground. And I think Susan Rice knows that pretty well. And I think there'll be a lot of people holding her feet to the fire if she tries to walk away from that commitment.
And one thing I add there, John and Neil, is that, you know, that peacemaking is the most cost-effective thing we can do. Just reassigning diplomats from desk jobs into conflict zones into the East and Central Africa region, to the embassies there, to work the accounts. Often we don't have any coverage on 24-hour coverage that's needed on these conflicts, and I think having people with experience invested in working with other countries and with the United Nations or whoever it is, the African Union, whoever is leading in whatever conflict it is, I think that we have a much better chance of success. And on the other side of the coin, the question you asked about the Darfur rebels, you know, there hasn't been, including particularly the 2006 efforts of the United States when the Deputy Secretary of State was out there, they've never had a deal on the table that addressed the bottom line concerns of the Darfurian people. So in this experience, their experience has been that those that have waded into conflict resolution have largely produced proposals that have been almost completely in line with the government of Sudan, what the ruling party has offered, and they feel completely burned by that, so they stay out of it. And as long as the government and some of the regional actors are providing money to some of these groups, they're going to splinter. But as soon as you have a credible effort, and this is the case, and it's a brilliant case study simply to look southeast a couple of hundred miles and see what happened in southern Sudan, which saw a similar pattern of eruption and splintering amongst the SPLA and the southern rebels during the 1990s. As soon as there was a credible peace effort on the table, most of those guys came back because they wanted to be part of what would potentially be a success story. They came back in, they ignored the government offering them all kinds of suitcases full of money, and they got behind one effort, one deal, one process, and eventually signed the deal. I believe the same thing has happened. We spent a lot of time with the rebel leaders in Darfur, and if there is a credible peace process with some serious, substantial proposals on the table that will address the fundamental issues within Darfur, you're going to see a lot of consonance in their positions.
And as John rightly notes, that I think UN forces work when they're in support of a credible and substantial peace process. They don't work instead of a credible and meaningful peace process, and I think that's exactly what we've seen in Sudan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the LA Times. Please state your question. Would you state your name also, please?
Hi, it's Ed Sanders from the LA Times. Well, your last statement made me, maybe I'll throw in just two quick ones. I mean, if the peacekeeping only works when there's a credible peace plan, then can it really work in Sudan, Somalia, and Congo right now? Because they're really, that's sort of what's lacking. So maybe peacekeeping is just, it's not time for peacekeeping in those countries, or that would be my question. And then the original one was on Bashir. John, you had mentioned kind of an opportunity to sideline Bashir, and it sounded like you had a scenario for almost a soft landing. But, I mean, how would that play out? I mean, how do you envision without Bashir, if Bashir sidelined or replaced? I mean, who controls, who becomes president of Sudan, and how do you prevent Sudan from just disintegrating back into war?
Can I go for it, John?
Sure.
Okay. The problem we've had over the last number of years now is any kind of strategic direction in the international. I mean, by the way, Hyatt, what we don't have is a clear, spelled out policy that will look for a solution, and as part of that solution, you deploy military assets to support the solution. What the Security Council has become is just reflexively. Like we're seeing today, this last month in Somalia, is when there is a problem to just hurl uncoordinated military force at that problem without any kind of a plan for solving the issue. In any of the business, that would be unacceptable. But I guess it's okay in international diplomacy, though the results cost billions of dollars and are complete failures. So. No, there is a purpose for military assets to be deployed now, but it isn't peacekeeping because, as you're pointing out in these three big combats, there is no peace to keep. You can use military assets to protect civilians. You can use military assets to observe ceasefires when they are secured. But just sending them out there as basically the largest element of international policy right now is a recipe for abject failure. So cart before the horse, basically. Got to get the peace processes, credible peace processes in place in order for peacekeeping elements to have any chance of succeeding. On the issue of Bashir, which is a really fascinating one, I mean, I'm pulsing these ruling party and opposition officials all the time, as I'm sure you are. You know, and there are many scenarios, but one of the most credible scenarios, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but it certainly has a very good shot of happening, is if, in the next 30 days, President Bashir is indicted for crimes against humanity and an arrest warrant is issued. We have in very short order the beginning of the campaign season. And I believe that the ruling party, the National Congress Party, could very easily make a decision to say, in the interests of the future, the President Bashir is going to step down as the candidate. He's had a great run, 20 years, killed a lot of people, kept us in power, and congratulations, good luck to you. And he goes off to Saudi Arabia to, just like Idi Amin, to protect himself from whatever storm might fall on him. And Ali Osman Taha, the second vice president, becomes the candidate for the NCP in the election. They, I'm sure, will, this will not be a free and fair election that we can all look to in African history as one of the high water marks for democracy, but, and he'll be backed by Saleh Ghosh and some of the others, and they'll be much more pragmatic and willing and able to make some of the necessary compromises to get a peace deal in Darfur. Their concern is that if everything disintegrates, that if the North-South war resumes and the SPLA goes back to the bush, combined with a war, a continuing war in Darfur, that would be an unsustainable two-front war for the ruling party. That is not an acceptable outcome. So I think that I think there is a chance, there is an opportunity that the ICC presents. It may not be the proponent odds right now, but I think it is a legitimate one. And the more the Obama administration quietly engages with some of the key leaders in the ruling party, the more opportunity we're going to have to influence the course of. Because if the ruling party perceives there is going to be a cost, an international cost, to continue to support an indicted war criminal as the president. They will make calculations. This is a survivor regime. This isn't the Taliban. This isn't Saddam Hussein going down with a ship. We're gonna see, I think, a much more pragmatic response from the guys that are running the show in the shadows. Okay.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. There appear to be no further questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and we'll talk again soon.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Follow up, and it will have a follow up in case anyone gets a brainstorm 5 minutes from now. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time, and have a great day.